Our next speaker is one of those, Paul Bogard.
Thank you, Eric. It's good to be here. I'm not usually here. I'm not usually with you all. I'm a creative writer, an English professor. But I was here a year ago. I was in Long Beach, and I was there to research a book that I'm working on that follows up this first book. And I had a great time. I went to a lot of panels, met a lot of people, and I've, in the year since, interviewed a number of those people for the new book. So I was really pleased when I was talking with Eric in North Dakota this summer, and he told me about this symposium. I thought it'd be a great idea to come join you all here today. Let me start just by introducing you to my work a little bit. This is my book, The End of Night. It came out a couple years ago in hardcover with the New York publisher Little Brown. It came out in paperback last summer. It has been translated into 5 languages, German, Spanish, Korean, Japanese, and Mandarin. And it's sold about 20,000 copies so far, so we're happy with it. The next book is the sequel, in the sense that in this first book I'm kind of talking about light pollution and how important darkness is. I'm looking up. The new book is called The Ground Around Us, so I'm looking down. It's the sequel in that sense. Let's see, do I? Yeah. I'll show you a couple slides from my usual show. I've given, about 60 talks on this book around the world. I'm going down to Colombia tomorrow to give another series of talks. I've never talked about the ground book, so this is the first time you all are getting to hear about that. But the books share a lot of similarities. I think at the heart they share the similarity that they are about our connection to the natural world and how it sustains us, and our separation from that natural world. So in the case of The End of Night, I always start off with talking about my childhood and how I grew up in northern Minnesota with a sky that looked like this. My nighttime was the Milky Way over pine trees, or the Milky Way over the lake, or the moon over water like this. I have lots of good memories of going out in the canoe and lying back on the bow and just soaking up the stars. And eventually, I believe that led to my book, The End of Night, and my work on behalf of raising awareness of light pollution and the many costs of it. Light pollution, I can show you, there we go. It's the overuse and misuse of artificial light at night. So it's not saying that light is bad, it's just saying the way that we use it is bad. I think the similarity I've already seen a lot in terms of our use of the ground or soil in particular. We're going to use the soil, we're going to farm, we're going to raise crops. It's how are we going to do that? And I've been learning a lot about that going about my book. Lots of examples here. You might just be interested here to see the spread of light pollution from the 50s, 70s, 90s, and 2025. That's an estimate, obviously. Let's see, there was one I wanted to show. Well, you may know the thing I wanted to show you was the shot of the Earth at night. You may have seen that, the satellite view of the lights from Earth. I actually talked with a soil scientist in Parma, Italy, who's used that same image to talk about soil sealing. So sealing over soil with concrete because of the connection between the spread of civilization, artificial lighting spreading with that, and concrete spreading that with that. So again, another interesting connection between the two books. I mentioned the similarity of between the two books in terms of our connection to and our separation from the natural world. A couple other ways I think the two books are real similar. One is that I am a non-scientist talking to scientists, writing for mostly non-scientists. So I see myself as a translator a lot of times. I certainly did that with astronomers, with physicians who were talking about the effects of artificial light on our bodies, ecologists talking about the effects on ecosystems, that kind of thing. I certainly will do that this time with this book. The other thing, too, is that the real subject of my first book is nighttime and darkness, and my love for those qualities of life, I would say, brought on by this kind of experience. This imprinted on me, and I love this. And so I know that I'm not a scientist, but I have friends who are scientists. I know that you don't use the word love a whole lot in your scientific papers, right? But at the heart of what we do, I think most of us, probably even in the room, is a love for the world. I hope that's true. It certainly is for me. And I love the ground. I love the soil. I tell the story of at the beginning of the new manuscript of my dog. I have had a dog for 15 years, a wonderful Brittany, a bird dog, who taught me a lot about the ground and the soil and the outdoors. And when she died a couple of years ago, it was very important that she be buried in what for me is sacred ground, holy ground. It's the ground at our cabin in northern Minnesota. So she'll always be there when I return. So this connection to ground, to soil, is really vitally important to me. In The End of Night, I begin with a poem by Wendell Berry, a wonderful agrarian farmer from Kentucky. Some of you may know his work. In this one, I begin with a poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins. I'll just read you a very brief stanza from it. This is called God's Grandeur. Generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and share man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. But that idea of just the ground being have been walked over so much, and now we're wearing shoes, we can't even feel it. And I thought I would read a little bit more about the new book to give you a sense of what's going on. So this actually comes from the proposal that I use as a writer to secure the contract from the publisher. This book begins with a simple premise. When we walk outside and look down, most of us in the industrial world see beneath our shoe-clad feet an unnatural surface, likely some version of asphalt or concrete. In fact, we have 61,000 square miles of paved ground in the U.S., an amount that together would be the 24th largest state by surface area, larger than any state east of the Mississippi. We now have more square miles of concrete in the lower 48 than we have square miles of wetlands. And every year, 1 million new houses and 10,000 new miles of asphalt seal over more natural ground. This isn't only the case in the U.S., of course. Since 1950, the paved surface area in the EU has grown 78%, while the population has grown only 33%. And in the ever-expanding cities of the developing world, the trend is true as well. That our modern world needs paved surfaces is nearly too obvious to state. The network of roads connecting our cities and countries allow us dramatic and dynamic freedom of movement, and concrete literally supports our daily lives. But we spend 90% of our daily life indoors. And as our cities and suburbs expand to domesticate more and more wild ground, the seemingly inexorable spread of pavement outdoors can be viewed as anything but progress. Increasingly, we live separated from the natural ground itself, a separation that conceals from us our profound relationship to the source not only of our food, water, and energy, but to the many intangible ways the ground sustains our lives. In short, the ground holds the facts that define us, but most of us know almost nothing of the world beneath our feet. I talk a little bit about hallowed ground and sacred ground, about burial grounds, that kind of thing, and about how we don't see the ground anymore, literally or even figuratively. We might not imagine we're missing a thing. What in the ground is there to see or know, and why would it matter? But just as the light pollution cutting us off from a starry sky symbolizes our separation from the rich value of darkness, our prevailing experience of the ground is symbolic of our separation from what the ecologist Aldo Leopold called the fountain of energy on which our future depends. The consequences of this separation run through every aspect of our lives. But to value the ground, we first need to know and understand it. And that is exactly what this book will explore. What we don't often think of, what we don't normally see, what is right here before us, the source of everything. Oftentimes when I'm talking about the end of night, my book on light pollution, I start by saying I'm not an astronomer, I'm a storyteller, I really tell stories, and it's my intention to tell stories about soil as well. In fact, I'm currently in the process of drafting my chapter on soil in particular, and I'm telling three stories, and I thought I'd just briefly tell you those in the time I have left. In the first story, I'm in England. I visit Helen Browning, who's the executive director of the Soil Association in the UK, and talk with her there, walk the farm, walk her organic farm there, which is a wonderful experience. In the second story I tell, there are three parts. In the second part, I visit, make kind of a pilgrimage, I would say. Maybe some of you have done this as well, to Aldo Leopold's shack in Baraboo in Wisconsin, and talk about Leopold's ideas about soil. It's interesting, too, in that second part, I also spend time in Virginia in a pine plantation with a woman named Kristen McElligott, who is a PhD student and a woman that I met at Long Beach. So that was a direct result of being at the soil conference. And then finally, in Iowa, I spend time with Fred Kirschenman talking about our relationship with soil. So the book, assuming I get it written, which I will, of course, but should be out in January of 2017, and hopefully I'll be at this conference again presenting that book in the near future. So thank you.